Time to podcast.
Welcome everyone into the Hyper Time. The Hyper Time to podcast. And I'm here with a special episode that's not a full-blown episode. So for anyone who has not listened to the wave riding, me basically admitting that I have failed as a podcast host and I've not been getting these out on time. And so the plan is to sunset Hyper Time and bring this series to a close. But that means that there's some stuff that I had started that I am not going to be able to finish. And some stuff that I had started that just wasn't a whole lot out there and wasn't worth putting into an episode. And so while I did delete quite a few of those latter things, I did still have some available on my Google Drive that I figured, you know what? I have it. Let me just get it out somehow. And so I came up with this brilliant idea of just word vomiting all of this stuff into one episode. And so what this episode is going to be is just different facts that I had found on some topics I had thought of that I am just going to kind of list out, mash together different topics into this one episode. I might, I guess, divide them up by like transition music so I can utilize those a little bit last time, and yeah, just kind of get those out there as this kind of like bonus episode. And then next week will be our the episode on Armageddon 2001, and then I think I'm going to try and drop them all, the last one as well, the following week after that on George Perez, and then the week after that will be a final kind of farewell episode as I dictate kind of how this series has went, what I plan on doing afterwards and all that stuff. But for this episode, as I'm sitting outside my children's school waiting for them to get off here in about 30 minutes while I'm sweating my butt off because it's like 85 degrees out and I don't have the car going, let me just do this. So here we go. Starting out with our first topic.
In the great
Tower of Babel,
League,
the JLA storyline by Mark Waid and Howard Porter. Now, this one actually started back during his time on The Flash. There was a point in 1998 where he took a break. And by he, I mean Mark Waid. Apparently, I didn't put him down. At that point, Grant Morrison and Mark Miller took over and had their acclaimed stint on the Flash book. However, this could also clash with Grant's time over on the JLA book he was currently writing, to the point where they got a little behind. So Dan Raspler, feeling Mark was partly to blame for taking time off of Flash in the first place, requested that Mark do a few fill-in issues for JLA. Now, this would be the four-issue section from 18 to 21, right before Grant finished his JLA run with World War III. That fill-in, though, would drive Mark a new direction. He really liked writing the JLA. It also made him finally get team books in a way he didn't before. He couldn't make huge changes to individual characters, as that would be done in their main books, but he could work on their relationships between the characters on the team itself. So he took that train of thought and ran with it. Now, Mark had in the back of his head for a long time a scene with Bruce Wayne. In particular, a scene where Bruce discovered his parents' bodies had been stolen from their graves. He hadn't seen that scene before, so he kept it in the back pocket, hoping never to see someone else pull it out before him. He latched onto this idea for Tower of Babel and linked it to another one he had during a short stint on X-Men. During that time, he had toyed with the idea that Professor X had a protocol in place for all of his students, that if the need arises, he could use them against his students. That never came to fruition there, but since Grant Morrison had brought up the idea in the JLA run, that Batman had every contingency plan he could fathom, which Mark thought would be the case too, Mark connected those dots. Batman would be Professor Xavier, and instead of the students, it would be the other JLA members. Well, technically all the members, all the superheroes in the world and stuff. Now, Mark Waid carried the idea over to Batman, having protections against the JLA, and boom, Tower of Babel. The twist, though, to create tension wasn't the fact that Batman had plans against the JLA. It was that he kept it all a secret, that he did it in the first place. That way, there wasn't only fractures in the team for that story, but after that story as well. Now, according to Mark, it was a way to bring different story ideas he already had in his head, such as Ross taking over the world using language, Bruce Wayne's parents being stolen, Batman's contingency plan, stuff like that. He could work them all into one story as opposed to multiple ones. When it came to determining what plans Batman would have, Mark would have some fun. He likes thinking of ways to take down heroes in ways that hadn't been done before, but also in ways that would make sense. He likes writing them into situations where they have to, in his own words, MacGyver their way out of. Now, Tower of Babel might sound familiar to those familiar with the story in the Bible. I'm not a religious person, so I don't know the story, but I've heard that phrase over the years. In the Bible, there is a group of humans who tried to build a tower that would reach the heavens. God saw this, and being his all-loving self, decided to alter their speech so nobody understood each other and then spread them across the planet. The city called Babel, most known as Babylon now, what they were building would be halted. In the story, Ross builds a tower that is used to confuse the speech and written language of the world. Now, the story arc resolves in issue 50 when Superman confronts Batman. The League is imploding because of trust issues, and Supes wants Batman on the team. So they take it to the team and completely open up. They reveal who they really are in the real world. And yeah, it's just like a good moment of clarity for everybody. Honesty and trust. So, great moment. Now, the event that Batman brings up in the series that leads to the... Sorry, let me turn on my car here. I'm like dying. I can't do this anymore. Turn on that air, so hopefully you might hear that pop on here. But in Tower of Babel, you have... Batman mention an event that takes place where the heroes get kind of mind controlled or their bodies switch out and they have to basically the heroes themselves become a threat. Now, this actually takes place in a 12-issue maxi series of one shots called The Silver Age. Each issue had a different team with an overarching story that I believe Mark Waid oversaw and wrote. I've tried to find them and read them. I didn't really have any luck. I don't think I found them on the DC Universe app, but also I don't think their search function works as great as intended. So it's possible it's on there, but I haven't read it. But Mark apparently decided to tie a previous work into that, which I originally thought there was an actual story, knowing Mark Waid from back in the 60s or something that he pulled from. But nope, it was all him, so... And then, lastly, for Tower of Babel, around that time, the Justice League Doom premiered. Mark Waid seemed to have some conflict going on with DC. That might be the reason he was not invited to the premiere of the movie that wouldn't exist without his original work, which is a shame because he should have been there, but, you know, we know that there are issues with him in DC in the past, so can't say I'm completely surprised, but, you know, good movie, had their own changes, but... Not quite as good as the original. Metamorpho, metamorpho,
metamorpho, metamorpho. This is the story of the Element Man. Metamorpho, metamorpho.
Also, I'm texting my wife here, so if you hear me tap, tap, tapping away as I'm reading, that will be why. But the next one I'm going to talk about is called Bloodline. And this, much like Armageddon 2001, I will talk about next week, is a kind of, calling it an event is a bit much. What DC were doing in the early 90s was they had like two issues that they would do, an issue one and then basically a bookend for this overall event that they would run throughout the summer that would tie in with all of the annuals of the main series, and Bloodlines was one of those. Now, at this time in the 90s, DC was committed to these yearly events. In 91, it was Armageddon 2001, followed by Eclipso, The Darkness Within in 92, and then 93, Bloodlines, which was an event about an H.R. Giger-esque alien species coming to Earth and inadvertently creating heroes after trying to feed on their spinal fluid by triggering their metagene. This would be DC's way of trying to create new, well, mostly new, heroes and maybe succeed in pushing them as ongoing books. Plus, as it was a collector's and speculator's market at the time, the idea of having a whole series of first appearances had a chance of more sales as well. And while I wasn't able to find a lot, I did run across quite a few sketches and designs for the alien creatures and their human forms. The artist I saw with them all was Arthur Adams, who includes them on his website as well. Arthur Adams has a love for dinosaurs and kaiju monsters in particular, so the designs of the Bloodlines creatures make a lot of sense with him behind the helm. I will put these on the website. I will put those on Twitter, so go check them out. Now, whether it was Adams or not who came up with the idea, I don't know. I did reach out to him. I didn't get a response back. But all the aliens themselves were based off of the seven deadly sins. So Praetor was based on pride. Gemir was based on greed. Lysik was lust. Slod was sloth. Venev is envy. Glomp is gluttony. And Engun is anger. Which I never piece those together because I'm too stupid, but on his sketches, he actually notes what they are, which makes a ton of sense. But so after the Bloodlines event was finished, DC launched seven books: Anima, Argus, Blood Pack, Hitman, Loose Cannon, Gunfire, and Cyber Rats. Hitman was obviously the only one that made a splash, resulting in a pretty poor launch of new heroes. But the heroes created during the Bloodlines story are often used as jokes in later years. Outside of a few who had their own series or mini, most faded into obscurity until they would be killed off in events such as Faces of Evil, Prometheus, or Infinite Crisis. To talk about some of those joke deaths, Dr. Light mentions in Blackest Night crossover how the Bloodlines heroes either died or were simply forgotten by the other heroes, while Wally West and Kyle Rayner in Hitman JLA note how lame they are and insistent with trying to team up with the League despite being incompetent. So you can see kind of how later writers felt about those characters. However, a different parasite returns many years later in Batman and the Outsiders Volume 2. In it, the parasite is a prisoner for a nightclub offering superpowers for a fee. The ending was not resolved, though, as Batman RIP would interfere with the story, leaving it hanging with Batman riding its back as it flew off after escaping. Superboy Prime actually kills five of the team members of Bloodpack in Infinite Crisis number 7, these being Ballistic, Geist, Mongrel, Nightblade, and Razorsharp. However, they do make their return in Blackest Night crossover when they get resurrected and hunt down Superboy Prime on Earth Prime, which he destroys them again. Funny enough, even though they were killed there, Geist and Night... Well, I guess it makes sense, because Geist and Nightblade make an appearance on Final Crisis 2, while Superman is in Limbo. So, yeah, them being dead, I guess, makes sense in Limbo. Surprisingly, they all probably should have been in Limbo. Outside of Hitman, one of the other Blood Pack members that didn't completely disappear was Sparks. Creator Carl Kiesel would find ways to bring her back in the stories, whether in his run of Superboy or Superboy and the Ravers. She even returns much later, whether it aiding the heroes after Bloodhaven was bombed in Infinite Crisis, or appearing as a potential Teen Titans recruit in Teen Titans number 66. Now, as it was the early 90s, DC tried to capitalize on Bloodlines in another way: trading cards. This would go along with the return of Superman cards, DC Cosmic Teams, Batman Animated Series. Of the 81 card set, 54 of them would show a picture on the front, not necessarily pulled from a comic, with a random puzzle piece on the back. If you collect all 54, you would get the image of a larger-than-Earth-sized The Taker. And The Taker was like the overall creature that these Bloodline creatures were trying to bring about. Now, while Doug Munch, again, I mentioned, this name came up in Armageddon 2001, too. I don't know how you pronounce his name because I've never heard it said out loud. Doug Moench, M-O-E-N-C-H. He would be responsible for the character design of Ballistic. And Joe Prado would actually make the designs for several of them to appear in Blackest Night and mix them up himself to fit that event. And so that's what I found for Bloodlines. Which, I love Bloodlines. A lot of people don't, but I love it. So, if you heard our very first episode, not Action Comics, but the episode in which we talk about what I wanted to do with the Hypertime podcast, there's a quick little comment in there about how the plan was to do 52. And 52, I know there's a ton of stuff out there about 52. Not just because there's stuff in the trade paperbacks, but because during that time, Newsarama was doing interviews with all of the creators, well, all the writers, and I believe Dan DiDio, Keith Giffen, all that on the books. And so, like, every week, you would get something new, detailed-wise. And so my links for that was just immense. It was going to be a monster undertaking, I guess, technically, and I just never got around to doing it. But one of the things I did do was I emailed Mark Waid, and although I could have emailed him about Tower of Babel or something I'm going to talk about here in a little bit, I instead went with the thing that I already had the most information about because I'm stupid. So here is an interview I did, interviews putting it a bit more formal. This is an email I sent Mark Waid along with his answers. So here's Mark Waid commenting on 52. Now, I ask him, I know you all wrote, plotted the story together. How did you all determine what scenes you specifically wanted to write, and did you all find yourself slowly gravitating towards certain characters over others? And he responds, in our first multi-day story conference in New York, as the four of us, Keith, JG, JG Jones, there we go, JG Jones, and Steve Wacker began plotting out, or blocking out our goals. If I recall correctly, it all began with looking at a list of the available players to see who we were excited about. Right away, we began gravitating towards certain characters. Grant towards the Space Heroes, me towards Elongated Man, Greg towards Rene Montoya, Jeff towards Booster Gold. So, as we began to build the story, naturally those characters rose in prominence thanks to enthusiasm, while others were added as natural outgrowths. Thereafter, each writer followed a certain set of characters and stuck to them throughout, with a few exceptions generally based on who was underwater on other deadlines at the time when someone else would pinch hit. Was there ever a point where either you specifically or someone else part of the team had severe doubts that a book would be out on time? About how far ahead were the books finished before they saw print? I can't remember a red alert moment any time. I do know that we ate into our lead time pretty consistently, and while we began 6 to 8 months ahead of release, maybe longer, we ended up taking that very last issue right down to the wire, which I do remember them commenting on with those Newsarama interviews. Because, yeah, those interviews, as they were coming out at the time, like, I was really into reading those. They're absolutely fascinating. So if you can, maybe I'll put some of them here. But yeah, I would say just Wayback Machine those and check them out. So that said, Grant once said, everybody likes to typecast Mark as the staunch traditionalist when in fact he's a super smart, witty, and a literary writer with no respect for authority, and he probably had more confrontations with editorial than any of the rest of us. Do you remember any of the editorial confrontations that he mentioned? And he says, I think no respect for authority was said tongue-in-cheek and actually translates to little respect for unearned, ignorant authority. Steve Wacker is my longtime friend, and Michael Siglane was a good guy, so I can't imagine any conflicts there, but there was a huge one with their boss. If you look again at one of the issues, number 42, the climax of the Ralph Dibny plotline, there's no writer credit listed. That's because I rewrote it 3 times based on notes from a higher-up who wanted to throw out 41 weeks worth of planning and didn't understand how stories work, and finally had to throw up my hands and say, I'm out. In a show of solidarity, the other 3 writers bowed out as well, leaving that issue to be written by editorial. I still hate that issue. Which, if you know, there was a lot of kind of back and forth between Mark and Dan DiDio. They did not see eye to eye. There is a famous quote that Mark attributes to Dan saying, hold on 1 second. There's a quote that Mark attributes to Dan DiDio saying that Countdown to Final Crisis would be 52 done right. Now, I'm always trying to give Dan the benefit of the doubt because I do like a lot of what Dan has done. That I want to say what he meant is that it was going to stick more to what 52 was supposed to be, which was supposed to explain the year of the whole DC universe. And what 52 ended up being was basically a very more centralized story about a certain set of characters. And then at the end, they were like, oh, yeah, we didn't do it, so we just got to kind of cram everything in there as to explain, like, oh, why this character has a new costume, what happened to this character, why does this person have powers, blah, 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 blah. I think what I want that quote to mean is that he was going to focus specifically Countdown doing what they set out from the very first issue. It failed. It failed very badly, but I can see that being what was meant. However, 52 is one of the best stories ever told in comics, and any sort of slight against that is going to get some pushback, especially if it's not a very thorough and explained out comment such as that. So it is what it is. It's been mentioned that Grant was the one who suggested an evil Skeets around week 11. Do you remember what the original plan was for the end of 52 before that idea came up? You are a riot. There was no original plan for the end. We were just vamping, figuring given a year, we'd come up with something. When lightning struck, Jeff and I were over in a corner just chatting, and Jeff idly muttered something about 52 Earths, and we were off to the races when I kept yelling at him, yes, yes, pitch that, that's great. Which, can you believe it? Like, I love 52, and the idea that they had no idea how they were going to end that seems incredible. Like, okay, we have 52 issues, we have no idea where we're going, let's just vamp this. And they vamped it, and like, it shows the talent that those men had to put out a book like 52 just willy-nilly, like without any real planning on where they were going. After 52, some stories would spin off, such as the Crime Bible story, Four Horsemen mini, Black Adam, and more. Were there ever any others planned? And more importantly, why didn't we get a Ralph and Sue Dibny Ghost Detective spinoff? That was probably my favorite story told and left with me wanting to see them again. You're hardly alone there. That was the plan. Ralph and Sue, Ghost Detectives. It was shut down by a higher-up, legendary for his disdain for anything that wasn't dark and grime, who flat-out lied to my face by saying Brad Meltzer objected, forgetting that Brad and I had each other's phone numbers. So again, he doesn't say it, but there's a history between him and Dan, so I can only assume he's speaking about Dan. But I could be wrong. I could be wrong. But Dan definitely has a legacy for his era there of being kind of, let's kill everybody, and dark and gritty is the best kind of storytelling. So, was it ever revealed why DC only brought back 52 worlds of the multiverse? I know the connection to there being 52 weeks in a year, obviously, but was there anything more than that? It always felt a bit limiting, especially when something like Hyper Time is right there, especially with you and Grant part of the project. And he says, at the time, Hyper Time was still verboten by management, and I agree that 52 worlds wasn't a lot, but it was the best compromise we could get. We never thought we'd get even that. And then lastly, is there anyone who you feel doesn't get enough credit for that series that you feel people should know about? Both Keith and JG. Keith kept the trains running on time and was the consummate pro, and JG was in all the story summits, just doodling away and throwing out the random thought from time to time. And while I can't remember specifics, I know that more than once, JG tossed out a gem. And so that is my little bit on 52. Wonderful. So now we go to another Mark Waid story, which I didn't realize until I was putting this together that apparently I was on a Mark Waid kick this during these sessions. But Underworld Unleashed, beloved event of mine that, for all of its problems, I really love. But the Mark Waid Howard Porter story event featuring Neron and, you know, changing up villains in the DC universe. After the success of the early 90s gritty storytelling, comics in general were trying to shake things up. For DC, part of that shakeup would come with Underworld Unleashed. This would be their big summer crossover event. They wanted to try and make updates to characters, specifically ones that were seen as outdated or too goofy. Think Captain Boomerang, Condiment King, Rainbow Raider, ones like that. Characters that may have worked during the Silver Age, but in these new times, just didn't feel right. The general consensus was that DC's villains were overall weaker and less threatening than Marvel's. Supposedly, Roger Stern compared DC to Marvel like this. Marvel has Galactus. DC has Matter Eater Lad. So enter Mark Waid. Anyone who has heard Mark speak knows how much he loves not just comics, but especially the Silver Age. But it fell onto him to try and make changes to these characters without going too far. While an event like Zero Hour had helped clear up the timeline, the villains didn't see the same sort of updates to designs that characters like Hawkman, Adam, and more would receive. Underworld Unleashed would be that moment. So Mark went to work. He originally intended to make big changes to some of these characters, and while changes would be made, some of the ones they changed didn't go as far as originally intended. In the trade paperback reprint, Mark notes how the characters were actually cooler than people gave them credit for, so while they were modified a bit to boost them up, they weren't done in a drastic way. The way this would be done is through the newly created Satan, or demon, Neron. Waid came up with the name Neron based on numerology, and that 666 ties in with that name. I tried looking into that, and it seems to come from a transliteration from the name Nero, from Greek to Hebrew, that adds in an extra letter, N. I hope I got that right. I don't understand numerology, but that was the best thing that I could find explaining that name. Now, Mark wasn't thrilled with how Underworld Unleashed turned out. In his own words from the trade paperback reprint, knuckleheaded, well-intended creators, ashamed of corny old characters, have been, for most of a decade, dragging half-forgotten heroes and villains kicking and screaming into their own little hardware store of creativity. There, haunted by a guilty fear that these ancient superdoers aren't cool enough for a generation of video game-entranced readers, said knuckleheaded creators fool themselves into thinking they're doing them a good turn by bludgeoning all the innocent charm and colorful individuality out of them. I tried that once. Learned a lesson. Now, the story was originally called Underworld, but a miniseries came out a few years prior with the same name, so they changed it to Underworld Unleashed. Sorry, here's the random trivia story I have for it. One of the coolest things about the book was the use of neon green ink. It was everywhere. But for the Underworld Unleashed 25th Anniversary Edition, much of that green would be replaced with white. In my opinion, the art suffers because of that change. Around the time Underworld Unleashed was ending, Jerry Ordway was also writing a 3-issue arc involving Captain Marvel and the demon Blaze. In it, he would have Captain Marvel do the same thing that happened in Underworld Unleashed. However, when he learned of Mark Waid doing the same thing, he rewrote the ending since the event was more important than an arc in a regular book. In Ordway's mind, both him and Waid may have been paying homage to the Thor 181, where Mephisto couldn't handle Thor's soul. Okay, I gotta hurry up here, because I only got like 7 minutes left before they pop out. Believing the hype of changing characters for the better, Mark Waid agreed on killing the Rogues. He regretted it, and it was done with zero intention of bringing them back. They were killed to prove that villains would be more threatening, and the Rogues just didn't fit in that expected universe. Although they died, Mark Waid would end up bringing them back during his Flash run in the story Hell to Pay. Flash ends up defeating Neron by giving up his love for Linda, which sounds a lot like One More Day, to save the souls of the Rogues, but their love was too pure for him to keep, so he let them remain together. Waid believes the best thing to come out of Underworld Unleashed was the Trickster's characterization, which I completely agree with. So much so that he found it disappointing when nobody ran with the idea of him reforming to avoid meeting the devil he pissed off once he died. Another aspect of the story that Mark thought was a mistake revolved around Blue Devil. The DC officer, officers. The DC offices had hoped Blue Devil could be something again, so they wanted some sort of push to reinvigorate the interest in the character. Mark tried, but in the end felt guilty doing to that character what other writers had done to his. And so, that is it. Those were some of the things I had been working with. Not a ton, but like I said, my least favorite episodes we have done are the ones where there's very little behind-the-scenes stuff and more where we're just talking about the comics, and we typically do that because I want to pad out some time. And in the case of these ones, that is exactly the type of episode you would have gotten with them. So I'm glad to at least get these out. I wish I could have gotten out all of the ones I had done before I deleted them away. But I'm glad I didn't have these just disappear. Because this took time. This took a lot of time. Sometimes that time doesn't result in any sort of reward. So, my kiddos are about to leave. So, I'm hoping that you will... Sorry, they're doing an announcement with a speaker, which I can hear outside. Kids are being bad inside. But anyways, I hope you enjoyed this little blurb of different facts. I'm going to try to remember to put the links in and stuff for it, of the ones I did have, but I'm making no promises there. I do promise that the stuff in here is accurate based on the links I have found, or that email to Mark that I had sent. But yeah, I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you will come back next week when we discuss Armageddon 2001. Take care. Bye.
This has been a VGU.TV production. For all of the hottest hot takes and other opinions on video games, music, and a lot more, tune in to VGU.TV.